Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
An Erio's original.
I've done shows where I tell my story on stage where people in literally Trump hats come to my shows.
God, yeah.
But at the end, they all come up and go, you know what? Nobody's ever told that story to me like you. And I understand.
I mean, food, it's like a Trojan horse. So it's a way to talk about other stuff sort of in the disguise of like the big wooden horse. It's like, oh, you think we're just going to talk about like kimchi stew, but actually we're going to talk about like politics and immigration. It's taking over my dreams, waking me out of my
sleep. I think I'm coming apart. Hi, I'm Margaret Cho. Welcome to The Margaret Cho, my podcast. Today we talk to the amazing Michael Yeo. He is an entertainment reporter, an amazing stand-up comedian, and my very, very good friend. He's amazing.
Yeah,
I'm coming out of the
dark. Yeah, but I just travel in the United States a lot right now.
Yeah, well, on the road and doing so many things. Now, I think that most people know you from all of your reporting. So
yeah.
You are definitely a very familiar face on entertainment, television, anything E-related.
Anything that starts with an E, I've been on. E.T.,
yeah.
Entertainment Tonight, Insider, I was on Extra. You know, so I've been on all the entertainment shows.
Which is really cool. Like, now, how did you... I actually tried to do this once, but I'll tell you. But how did you get into starting to do this?
So I did a radio show in Miami, and the radio show was really big. And at the time, a gentleman named Ted Harbor was the president at E. And he heard my radio show and was like, this guy needs to be on TV.
Oh.
And literally, I got a phone call. Annie from Annie Marine in, I'll never forget it, Tiffany. And they brought me in for casting just to see what I look like on camera. And 6 months later, I was on E! News in the Daily 10. And it's one of those things where when I first got hired, I didn't know how hard it was to get on TV.
Yeah.
And I always appreciate it. But until I moved here and saw the industry, I mean, it's so crazy. I got a random phone call out of nowhere and never did TV. And now I'm on TV on a national platform.
Well, I mean, but you, I think because you are very natural there. I mean, it's kind of a hard thing to do, you know, showbiz reporting, because it's like, it's very specific. But some people are very natural at it, you know, whether it's yourself or somebody like Greg Kinnear.
Yes.
You know, people see him and they go, oh, I really want to get this kind of news from this person, because it makes sense. It's a very specific kind of identity.
It is. People want to know, like, first of all, people want to like you.
Yeah.
And the biggest compliment I learned as a host on the host side is when they don't call you a host. They go, they think they know you.
Right.
Because you come across TV as a friend.
Yeah.
They go, man, I know you. You know, I watch you all. But when they go, oh, you host that show, then they see you as just a host.
Right.
And sometimes you're so good where in their head, they think they actually know you. Did we go to school together?
Yeah.
And that means more to me than being, oh, you're that host on that show. Because when you get categorized as a host, which we know in Hollywood, is a great thing in some cases, but a bad case in a lot of things.
Yeah.
I remember going to castings and people would go, oh, you're a host. Okay, go ahead, do the lines for acting or anything else. Now that I started doing stand-up, it's like, I saw you at the Laugh Factory, the improv comedy store, and you can host? Oh my God, this is amazing. So it changes the game.
No, it definitely makes for a much more diverse portfolio.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Which I love. People always think that I work at Buffalo Wild Wings. They go, do you work at Buffalo Wild Wings? I've had that question.
You've had people ask you that.
Quite a few times, actually.
Are there a lot of Asian Koreans that work at Buffalo Wild Wings or something?
I don't know, but I think that I have a face that people are like, I know you from somewhere, but I feel
but you're not famous. It's Buffalo Wild
Wings. I think you work at Buffalo Wild Wings, you know, but it's always Buffalo Wild Wings. So I'm like, maybe I should, I've never even been to one, so I should investigate.
You would probably kill it at Buffalo Wild Wings.
Maybe I should get into the franchise.
You know,
maybe
hey, get yourself a franchise.
Margaret chose Buffalo Wild
Wings. I like that.
So my impression of you is that you started as a stand-up comedian and went into this reporting journalism.
Uh-huh.
But actually, it's the other way around.
The way around. Yes. I never wanted to do stand-up. I was a huge fan of stand-up, but I never dreamed in a million years that I would do stand-up. It wasn't on my list. And then I was on Chelsea Lately when it was at its prime. I was on all 7 years, and I would fly around to interview celebrities. Ooh. And everywhere I went, everywhere I landed, people go, where are you performing tonight? Just because I was on the round table with comedians, they considered me a comedian when I really didn't tell any jokes. I was there to report the news because I was the news guy on Chelsea. Yeah. So I gave the facts.
Yeah.
But people just assumed since I was there, I could do comedy too.
Mm-hmm.
So finally, I remember like it was yesterday, I tweeted, hey, I think I'm going to try stand up. And the next day I'm on Chelsea and Chelsea stops the show and goes, oh, you think you can just try stand up? It's so easy. And the thing I said, and I was just talking out, I go, it doesn't look that hard. And the whole round table and Chelsea were like, okay, whatever. So Chelsea challenged me to go on stage. Mm-hmm. I went on stage in Miami. And the first time I did 15 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah, but I didn't know I did 15 minutes. It was nerves.
Yeah.
I just did a bunch of crowd work and stuff, and I didn't know where a light was. So they were like, just look for the light. I didn't know where a light was. I was so nervous.
Yeah.
So when I got off, it was 15 minutes later, but that energy is in. And I got off the stage, I called my mom. I was like, this is what I was born to do. I love it so much.
Oh.
I love it because I think in Hollywood, where we live, you get a lot of no's.
Mm-hmm.
And to be able to go on stage and get 400 yeses at once when you perform, it really helps you balance the industry out here.
Right. Yeah,
for me, because go to casting, no. Go to Laugh Factory, Improv, Comedy Store. Oh, yeah, you're great being yourself.
Right.
And that was most important is now when I go in to do shows, I'm so confident in myself, and stand-up has done that.
Yeah.
Because you know, when you first start, it was hard finding my voice,
mm-hmm.
and you're like, oh, I'm going to be like this person. And then when you finally find yourself, it's weird where you stop performing for them, and it's more about you, the message you want to get out. And if they think it's funny,
mm-hmm.
but as long as you think it's funny.
Yeah, and that's, I think, really important. Now, I know that you do a lot of material about being Korean. I think of you as Korean.
No, I'm 100% Korean.
But you're also Black.
I am 100% Black.
So you are, your spirit picked the two ethnic identities that are fiercely kind of like...
competitive.
Oh, they have ownership. Like, they're like, you know, we always sort of think, like, Asian people are always like, well, they're Asian. Like, Tiger Woods, oh, he's Asian.
Yeah.
They're like...
And then Black people are like, he's Black.
Oh, he's Black. Yeah, we like to claim it, maybe because there's not so much representation out there in the world, so we want to claim those identities for ourselves.
100%. And I struggled with that growing up. I went to an all-white school.
Ooh.
And my parents were like trendsetters in my area. Like, it was the only interracial couple in Houston, Texas.
Yeah.
So it was interesting being me... because, you know, you hang out with the Asian kids, the Black kid, and there wasn't many Asian or Blacks, but when you did hang out with one ethnicity, if you hung out with the Blacks, then the Asians would get mad, then you hung out with the Asians, the Black kids would get mad. White kids didn't care.
Yeah.
You know, so it almost like I felt that they treated me more fairly than everybody else, but they treated me fairly because I was so different. It wasn't like they respected. They were like, oh man, he's different. Let's learn about this guy.
Yeah.
You know, but everybody wants to learn. It was kids. They say stupid stuff. I got called terrible names growing up, like nigga chank.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
But it was a thing that I think today
mm-hmm.
I benefit from it because now it's my comedy. Now it's everything I talk about.
Right. And it's about like, I mean, I think in comedy, the best material is always from identity. Like it comes from this place of like, well, this is where I can actually very specifically speak from a very, like, kind of a painful place, an honest place, but also it makes it really funny.
Yeah.
And I think if you have, like, an Asian mom, it's really a gold mine, I found, of course.
Oh, of course. I'm the same way. I mean, we both have mothers that will say, no filter, say whatever they want. And, like, my wife, I married my wife. I remember 2 days after I married my wife, my mom looks at my wife and goes, you have dry skin.
Oh,
and I'm like,
no.
Like, my wife is like, no, I don't. She goes, are you white? And my wife goes, yeah. She says, well, you have dry skin. So, I mean, but now she uses all the Korean. But she doesn't have dry skin, but she loves the Korean products. My mom bought her this extravagant Korean face creams and all this stuff. So now she loves it. She uses it every night. But it's the thing about Asian moms. They just say anything.
Yeah.
And like the big thing my wife is talking about now, my mom used to have long hair and my wife has very long hair. And my mom, I think they get misinterpreted because they don't know what they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
My mom told my wife that, I used to have long hair, but mine was thick, not thin like yours.
Mm.
But my mom thinks, because it was hot, that there's no way she could survive with that much hair if it was super thick. So it has to be thin.
Yeah.
But she wasn't saying, oh, your hair is thin. That's an insult.
Right.
You know, she was going, oh my gosh, it must be thinner than mine because there's no way my hair could be that long in the summer. But my wife took it as she thinks I have thin hair.
Oh, no, no.
No, no, you're misinterpreting it. No.
It's almost like, I think the Korean thing is that we're not going to talk to you unless we're talking about something that we can help you with. Like, it's kind of like every time you speak, it's like, we have to benefit you somehow. Like, this has to be beneficial to you. And it's not meant to be insulting, and it's not meant to be hurtful. It's just like, well, I'm older, so that means I can give you some advice in some capacity.
Some very straightforward advice, no sugarcoating.
Yeah, which isn't, you know, the American way is not to ever mention those kinds of things. Even if it's not true, we could maybe, she could even fabricate something that maybe I can help you with this, you know?
It's the thing where I just like growing up is weird in a Black and Asian household because no one, I don't know if it was the same with you, but my parents never told me they love me.
Yeah.
They don't use the word love.
Mm-hmm.
Like I kind of forced my dad at 29 to tell me he loved me.
Aww.
Yeah, it was very weird because I didn't even know that was a thing.
Yeah.
And now I'm learning, like I didn't know people were supposed to say it that much.
Right.
Because my parents never told me they loved me till I called them out on it.
Yeah.
You know, so, but here's the thing. I never knew you were supposed to do that. And now I'm learning from my wife. She's white, born in Wyoming.
Ooh.
So I'm learning a lot of things that seem racist that people do. A lot of people or things that people don't agree with, they just don't know.
Yeah.
Just think about it. I was in relationships with people and I didn't know you were supposed to say I love you.
Oh, yeah.
And so people are like, oh, he's so rude. He's so this, he's that. And I'm going, oh, you were supposed to do that? So I just was ignorant about it because from my upbringing.
Yeah.
And now I'm learning, like, with my wife, she's from an all-white family.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Wyoming, as white as you can get.
Yeah.
Her family's amazing. But there's a lot of things that she thinks is funny. Like, for instance, true story, we leave a restaurant. So it's my wife, her mom, and our son. And they're waving bye to me. I'm at the stoplight. And the light turns green. And a cop car behind me goes, woo, and flashes their lights.
Uh-huh.
So the cop car follows me for about a mile and then turns off. I get home, my wife, my son, and her mother are there, my mother-in-law, and they go, oh my God, wasn't that funny? The cop flashes lights at you. I bet you thought it was for you, but it was really for Oliver. The cop was waving at Oliver, our little son.
Oh.
But wasn't that funny? You probably thought you were going to get pulled over. And in my mind, I go, no, it's not funny.
It's not.
Because I'm thinking, and this is honest, I may never see my family again.
Right.
What am I going to say to this cop?
Right.
They've never had to deal with those social injustices like that. They think if you're good to a cop, they're going to let you go.
Yeah.
You know, nothing's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Where I grew up in Houston, where I've been in cars that got profiled
right.
and pulled over. So it was interesting, and eventually it'll get to stage once I learn how to present it or figure out how to present it. But it's those differences where they thought it was funny mm-hmm. that a cop flashed their lights at me and I thought I was going to get pulled over. Yeah. Where in my mind, I'm going, I may literally went through my head. So many people are getting killed for reasons that don't. What am I going to say? What am I going to do? Is my insurance up to date? Will I ever see my
right?
Will I ever see my family again? And those are the true, actual things that are going through my mind. Where they thought it was funny.
Yeah. Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's not that they're like, oh, they just don't know.
They just haven't had that experience.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, yeah, that the idea of privilege, you know, people don't feel it because they've never noticed it as privilege.
Yeah, it's just every day for them.
Yeah, it's just a given.
It is. And I think sometimes people get turned off by the word privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people just associate privilege with money.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, privilege, yeah, it's about money, but it's about social justices and yeah. injustices that happen more than money.
Yeah.
Like, because I see the biggest complaint where people go, oh, you're saying I'm privileged. Well, I'm at my 9-to-5 job too, and you probably make more money than me. It's not about that.
No.
It's not about money. It's about how different people start at different places.
Exactly.
And you have to just recognize that.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
as long as you recognize that, mm-hmm. we're not asking you to change. It's kind of like if you know you're from a very wealthy family,
mm-hmm.
you're going to start way further than a kid that's not from a very wealthy family, because you're going to have the best schools
mm-hmm.
and this kid isn't. This kid is going to have to struggle more to get to a place that you're already at.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
how can you not acknowledge that? No, there are opportunities for everybody
mm-hmm.
in America. Everybody has the same opportunity,
mm-hmm.
but not everybody starts at the same place.
Right.
And I think today, if you want to go that route, the political route, I think people are yelling at each other mm. and not talking like that.
Right.
People are just not having this conversation where how can you not acknowledge that you're starting further
mm-hmm.
than someone?
Yeah.
And let me tell you, there's a lot of white people that don't start further.
Right.
They're starting with the poor people
mm-hmm.
That live in a terrible areas. They have the worst schools.
Yeah.
There's a lot of white people, Latino people, Black people, Asian people, a lot of ethnicities.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as you acknowledge not groups of people, I think you need to acknowledge certain stories.
Mm-hmm.
Like if I come to you, say I was middle class, I don't have the same struggles as a Black kid from the hood,
mm-hmm.
you know, but I noticed the difference. I know I had more opportunities than the kid. If we were in a 100-yard dash,
mm-hmm.
I had a 25-yard head start.
Yeah.
Where a person that's from a very wealthy family has a 50-yard head start.
Yeah.
Now, we all have a chance to win that race,
mm-hmm.
but this dude in the hood has to run twice as fast or four times as fast as everybody else.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
has to go through a lot more struggles to get there.
Right.
And as long as you acknowledge that and don't be blind to that,
mm-hmm.
I think we can move forward. And people just need to stop yelling at you and talk.
I know.
And
I
that's
know.
What it is.
It's so important. I mean, I think a lot of those things, those inequality things, I think that comes about, like now we're talking about it more because of that mindset of like, we want to have intersectionality
yes.
and learn to talk to each other in a way that it has understanding. And so we can somehow avoid fighting as we've been doing. And I think art helps. I think movies, TV, all of that is helping us get there, you know, but it's interesting. I think like, did you always sort of understand this because of being kind of because you're outside, you're Korean, you're Black, you're outside of these cultures that are so fiercely protective of themselves.
And also we're pitted against each other in
right.
movies.
Right.
I mean, any Black movie, you walk into a liquor store and it was an Asian trying to kick you out.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so that's Boys in the Hood, that's Menace to Society. Those are the movies I grew up with.
Yeah.
And I was the two polar opposites that were right. always banging up against each other.
Yeah.
But one thing I learned from my dad is, you know, he marched for equality.
Mm-hmm.
So I always learned from, and I've never to this day heard my dad say anything bad about white people.
Mm-hmm.
Even though white people, at that time, there was a lot of prejudice against
yeah.
him. And
yeah.
he still got a PhD in nuclear physics.
Wow.
So it's a story, but he never blamed anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I come from that frame of mind where you know there's ignorant people.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to deal with it, but you got to keep moving towards your goal. Don't yell at people. Just try to talk to them.
Right.
If you're making common sense and they're just yelling,
mm-hmm.
you're not going to win that argument anyway.
Right.
But I've done shows where I tell my story on stage where people in literally Trump hats come to my shows.
God, yeah.
Because when I'm on, when I do press, I go, I don't talk about me. I don't talk about politics.
Yeah.
So I think people try to test it.
Yeah.
And so they come out, but at the end, they all come up and go, you know what? Nobody's ever told that story to me like you. And I understand.
Yeah.
You didn't yell at me. You didn't. But like I said, there's so many other people that can talk about politics way better than me.
Yeah.
So I think my thing is more of trying to bring people together through comedy. That's my thing.
Yeah.
Where I think other comedians, I mean, go for it. That's mm-hmm. your thing. Like mine is more, I didn't have the struggles. Mm-hmm. Like it's kind of like a rapper. I'm like the Drake. You know what I mean? Like I'm the Taylor Swift of hip hop.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like I don't have problems.
Yeah.
So my comedy is more about joy and life and loving your family.
Uh-huh.
Because I'm not going to talk about something I didn't have.
Right.
You know, and I don't think, but I know social issues affect other people differently than me.
Yeah.
So they should talk about it.
Yeah. Who are your favorite comics?
Right now? Or like I grew up with Eddie Murphy mm-hmm. and Richard Pryor. And yeah. then I listened to Red Fox Records.
I love Red Fox.
Oh,
so dirty.
Yes.
He had a Korean wife.
Did he really?
Yeah. His last TV show, was it called The Royal Family?
Something,
It was, and I went to some event. This is in like early 90s. That was being held for him. And then I think he had passed away. And then his widow came and spoke. And she was wearing full-on hanbok. Straight up
really?
Korean, barely spoke any English. And it was really, I didn't know. I was like, oh, okay, that's cool.
Yeah, right? Koreans are taking over it, so.
I was like, and when somebody has an Asian wife, I'm kind of like, that's kind of cool. But then I don't agree. Like, Sun-Yi and Woody Allen. But...
Yeah, well, people are shocked that Dave Chappelle has an Asian wife.
Yeah, it's cool.
You know, like, it's cool. So they got little Blasian kids running around, too.
That's great. Also, Wayne Brady.
Wayne Brady as well.
Yes.
Absolutely.
I love that.
I just think it's a thing where, as Koreans and as being black, like, it's now it's so funny that today, when I was growing up, everything that people made fun of me mm-hmm. is now in.
Yeah.
People made fun of my big lips. Now everybody wants their lips big.
Yeah.
You know, like half black people are in. Obama, Tiger Woods, Steph Curry. You know, like everything is just turned mm-hmm. to favor me.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's just weird being dogged about something and now you're loved about something.
It's great.
You know, and do you feel the same about, here's what I noticed about stand up, and I've only been doing it 9 years, but is it just me or the Korean community isn't really, they don't follow comics or Koreans like Filipinos follow their people.
Oh, yeah.
Like they're not very supportive.
Well, I think they are. I think it is what it is that it's changing. I think that a lot of that is shifting because we're seeing a lot more like comedy shows with Asian nights,
uh-huh.
you know, that I think people are very responsive to.
But
the Korean community, I think because of the LA riots, they were incredibly protective of their image. And so I was starting comedy around then and on TV, and they really were angry that I was somehow tarnishing the image of Korean Americans, like somehow being really nasty. And I got a lot of kind of really nasty talking to phone calls, like very angry Korean elders really mad at me. But fortunately, all those people are dead. So it's just me. Like, I'm the elder now.
Yeah.
And so I think that things are changing. But yeah, we don't have those things of like, because I think when, the Filipino community, incredibly supportive.
Oh, my
of
goodness.
Their comedians.
Yes.
And, we don't necessarily have that in Korean. But I think we're getting there. I think also what's happening is Asian Americans are uniting as one much more now these days.
Yes.
You know?
It's interesting. Like, I love, doing these Asian nights. I pop on. I'm hosting a Korean Community Center event at Walt Disney World in a couple of months.
Wow.
So it's a thing where I love being involved with the community because mm-hmm. the community, for the first time, and this is Hollywood. You know, I've been here the last 12 years. But it's the sense of pride. And it started with John Chu and Crazy Rich Asians. You know,
mm-hmm.
it seems like that movie has kind of moved things forward.
Yeah.
And now people are really starting to take control of their careers and really, like, I love turning on my TV and Ken Jeong's everywhere. You know, I was performing at the Improv watching TV and he's on a commercial.
I love
I love seeing it and I love how supportive he is.
He is. He's great.
And I think it's a time where with Asian comics, now is the time for us to support each other because there's room for everybody.
Yeah, there is.
There is. And I think you're very supportive of other Asian comedians and just supportive of the whole community of comedy.
Yeah.
You know, you've always been great to me. So it's a thing where I think we need to take a cue in from past comedians. When I even started 12 years ago, it was more competitive.
Right.
And I think because there was the stage was the only outlet.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody competed for that stage.
Yeah.
Now there's so many outlets to get your product out.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's kind of now is what I like about comedy now. If you have a big podcast, everybody wants to be on your podcast so you can support everybody.
Right.
Too. So there's no competition really because everybody's supporting everybody because it helps everybody.
It does.
And that's what I like today.
I love that. I love that. I think that's really marvelous. I think my favorites right now in terms of comics.
Oh, yeah. I didn't answer the question. Yeah. Sorry.
But like I really love a Jimmy O. Yang.
Love Jimmy.
He's so different. To me, he's like so, I mean, like, that's like the new generation.
Yeah. I love Jimmy. I love, you know, I'm old. I still love Bill Burr. You know, I love Bill Burr. I love Dave Chappelle, of course.
Yeah.
Fahim Anwar.
Mm-hmm.
I like him. He's always at the Comedy Store. Like, I like to watch comedians that don't go over my topics. That, you know, because I never want to feel like I've taken something or even an idea from another comedian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I don't watch, like, I watch comedians that I definitely couldn't do that act.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm not mad enough to do ever copy a joke from Bill Burr, you know, or even want to. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
So I like to watch more highbrow comedy than me. Like, I'll watch a lot of political humor, like Bill Maher and things
Bill's
like
great.
That. But I won't watch, like, a Cosby or a Gaffigan or even Kevin Hart to a certain extent because he talks about his family a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But I love Kevin Hart as a person.
Yeah.
But I try to stay away from it because I never want to feel like, oh, I heard this from them. And then I don't know where you stand on that, but I hear an idea and I'm like, did that come from them or was this original to me? And how do you navigate it?
Well, I mean, I think it's also the way that I think of things. It's kind of a little bit, it's a little weird. Like actually Jerry Seinfeld described my comedy as, you know, quirky artisanal handmade jewelry that I would sell on like a piece of like felt in like a park, which I think
at a farmer's market.
Yeah, like I'm like selling like the feather earrings at the farmer's market of comedy, which I think that is actually very true.
Yeah.
So I have a feeling that the way that I'm going to see something is probably so different that it might never really replicate another comedian, I think.
Yeah.
So, but I know that's definitely a thing. Like, because there are a lot of things of like, you know, especially when things happen in culture, everybody's got to say something about it.
Yes.
And there's not that many funny responses. You're always going to have the same thing as maybe another comedian. It's like there's certain reflexes that we do that are all going to be kind of the same.
Same, yes.
So I think, you know, there is that sort of danger. But then also right now, material, you have to write so much so fast that a lot of it is a bit dispensable, I think.
And do you do a lot of dispensable material? Or you're a very topical writer.
I try to, just to keep it sharp and keep it going. Also, I can't resist sometimes because there's so many, like, I love following news all the time.
Absolutely.
So there's so many things. So I think that there's, like, you know, there's a need for it, too.
But do you go up enough where, after you write a bunch of stuff, is there that need to go up, or are you satisfied sometimes just writing it and go, all right, I know I'm not going to be up in a week and it'll be old by then, but
then you can either, maybe it would become like a social media thing.
Yeah.
You could tweet about it or something, or that it could go into, and then also like, I'm old enough to do like, sort of like you have archetypes that you make jokes about that you could just change the name. That's very like, that's kind of like Joan Rivers, is that she had all these jokes about Elizabeth Taylor that you could actually just put in the person of the moment. So then it would be Paris Hilton, then it would be Lindsay Lohan, and then it would be the Kardashians, you know? So there's a kind of thing of like society or showbiz seems to replicate the same Absolutely. Archetypes. And so you can use those jokes again in 20 years time or whatever.
So do you have a big card catalog? I know this is, I'm on your pie, but I'm so interested and fascinated with your comedy. I mean, do you write everything out and have it like stored somewhere? Or?
No, but I don't know. There's probably something place in my brain that you store jokes. Yeah. That, like, this never worked, but it's got to work at some point with somebody somewhere.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe that's it. You know, that it sort of sticks in your brain.
Wow.
I don't have the card catalog. I wonder where that card catalog is. It's probably at the Smithsonian or something.
I would imagine. And I have to ask you one question.
Yes?
Because, you know, you were you the first Asian American with a sitcom back in the day? So,
yes.
Looking back on that, because now a lot of us are getting opportunities to do sitcoms and things like that. What is one piece of advice that you learned way back then that you could pass on to a person like me or any other person that, like, that's Asian that's coming out with a podcast? Sitcom.
Yeah, anything really. I mean, I think it's just to listen to your own instincts because they're going to be the best, and that people are going to try to tell you things that would be good for you, but you're actually going to know. That, you know, I, from my experience, I gave so much trust to people who really had no idea what was right and what I needed to do. And just because I thought, well, I don't know, these people know television way better than I do. But actually, that wasn't true. I actually held the answer. So I think the most important thing as any artist, you've got to trust yourself first and make your own voice the most important. Uh-huh. But that's a hard thing to do for a lot of people.
Is that what you would have changed?
What I would have changed. That, and I would taken more hair vitamins. Because my hair, it was so great then, and now it's not that great. But I, you know, those are the two things that I would have done. Oh, maybe wore sunblock.
Sunblock. More sun. The big hats, the gloves. Yeah.
I should have been more like, you know, that Korean Gulf attitude where you know skin is like it's exposed to the sun at all.
It's amazing to see Koreans golf. They cover every part of their body. It's how do they not get hot?
Don't know, but it's every single in their hands. It's
the hand,
gloves.
They have gloves on, but the gloves that come halfway up their arm too. It's insane.
And then they'll have the driving glove with the screen they can't see. I mean, I think that's why that there's like that weird thing about Asian drivers can't see. It's because they have so much sun protection that they can't see out of the car.
But isn't it? Don't you hate that stereotype though? Because it's true.
Yeah,
it is so true.
I'm the worst driver.
Are you really?
I'm terrible.
See, I'm a good driver.
Yeah.
I'm a good driver, but every time I see somebody do something stupid on the road, I literally go, please don't be Asian. Please don't be Asian. And they're Asian.
Yeah.
And I hate that stereotype.
It sucks.
And I don't understand why. Why is that? I really don't understand why.
I don't know. Is it kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy if you tell yourself these things? It's like the secret. Like, if we think about it, then it'll happen. You know?
It's like, this is my lane. And they really mean, this is my road.
Yeah. We've taken it over somehow.
I don't know, man, but that's one stereotype I really hate. And that's true.
It's not. Well, it's something we've got to change.
You know what? 2020, that's what we're going to do. We're going to change the stereotype on Asian drivers.
Yes. That's the thing. Now, we're almost at the end. I just want to ask you, what is your what's up for 2020? We're going to be 2020 soon.
Yes. Hopefully.
What are you doing?
Well, definitely well, I'm working on my new comedy. I have a comedy special out on Amazon Prime. It's called Blasian. And now I'm working on the second one.
Yes.
And I should be shooting by the end of 2020.
Wow.
And it's all about family and it's all about my wife and kid. And hopefully by then we'll have another kid. We'll see, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, now everybody wants a girl.
Oh.
You know, my mom is pushing us really hard to have a girl.
Yeah.
You know, like we can't, you know, we'll see. But that's what I want to do. And I'm really excited to see this election. Because it's going to get so dirty.
And so crazy.
And what I love, like, and maybe you totally disagree. And look, I know all the bad Donald Trump has done, but I feel that at certain times, sometimes bad needs to happen for people to realize they don't want to be like that.
Right.
And you know, when I always try to make a negative into a positive. Mm-hmm. So when people go, oh, Donald Trump's president, I go, but look how many people he's brought together.
Yeah.
even if it, by all the people that hate the way he's governing the country.
Yeah.
Like, you had 500,000 women march because of Donald Trump. You had people supporting Muslims because he attacked them.
Yeah.
That wouldn't have happened if Hillary was president.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, I mean, that's the good, is I found that he's bringing people together that usually wouldn't have come together just to go against him.
Right.
Yeah, it's terrible, the lies and things like how women aren't believed, but they're supposed to be believed on every other case, like a Harvey Weinstein. And you know, I hate that he gets away with a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But on the positive side, I do feel that he's brought so many people that oppose him together, and they're fighting for the same cause, where a lot of times people are separated and just into their own worlds. Now people are like, oh, this is our world. We kind of got to take it back.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm bowing.
I know. It's a podcast. I'm bowing.
You had a bow. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was awesome.
That was great.
We have an amazing conversation with Lucas Peterson, who is an incredible food critic, writer. He's the host of Dining on a Dime for Eater, and he's amazing. You'll love him.
Yeah, I'm coming out of the dark.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Right.
Right.
Although people on juries probably don't know enough to go down there. I guess maybe now you could turn your phone on.
Yeah.
But it, yeah, it's a sticky restaurant. So, well, thanks for getting up for us.
Thank you for having me here.
I'm such a fan.
Your show, your ABC show came out when I was in high school.
Wow.
And it made such an impression on me.
Oh.
That, it, yeah. So that's all I'll say. I felt like it was a show that was sort of born too soon, but it was really like a mind-blowing thing to see at the time on TV. I remember just that registering for me.
I'm so grateful. Well, thank you.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, because at that time, this is 1994,
we
really thought that this might be a change. There would be a change because at the same year, All American Girl came out. The Joy Luck Club came out. And so, you know, for the first time, for a lot of us, we were seeing Asian American faces, hearing their voice in the movies and on television. You would think that there would have been some real shift.
Right.
But, you know, it didn't happen again until 25 years later, of course, now with Fresh Off the Boat and Crazy Rich Asians. So hopefully this is, you know, something that's here to stay.
Do you think it is? Like, I'm honestly wondering about your opinion. You hope so?
I hope so.
Okay.
I would like it to be. You know, it's the thing is, the trick is to really see more. And I think that, you know, Always Be My Maybe came out on Netflix. And, of course, Ali Wong has her specials, which are so great.
Which are incredible.
And Ken Jeong also doing a lot of specials. Awkwafina's in quite a few movies all the time now. So that's really great. So I think that hopefully now there would be more of a sense that we would see more Asian Americans. But I mean, you're an actor too, so.
I mean, formerly a very bad one.
No.
And with a very undistinguished career.
No,
which is why I had to sort of like focus on writing, because like things were so bad.
Well, I understand. I mean, I did a lot of stand-up comedy. I mean, I think that I had to form another industry. I couldn't just do it all on acting.
For sure.
You know, and I think that's quite true for a lot of Asian American actors out there, that we look into other industries to sustain us and then become well-known in those industries.
Yeah.
So that we can kind of do both, which I think is really good. And
yeah.
That's good. And we sort of, like, if you're an Asian American actor, you kind of have to be able to do everything.
True.
You know, that you have to have the range, because we're called on, just you just never know what's gonna come up for casting, when the breakdowns or whatever they do now. You know, whatever it is, whether it's I'm usually some kind of a cop or a doctor.
Yeah, I am usually a computer technician,
mm-hmm.
or also a doctor.
Yeah.
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 Or sometimes I'll be the person of color, voice of reason.
Okay. Wait a minute. Put the gun down.
Yeah.
Right.
It's like, person. There's always the person of color in whatever production that is the reality check.
So I'm half Chinese. Mm-hmm. I would walk into auditions and I would frequently tower over everyone else in the room who was being called in for computer technician mm-hmm. part on whatever procedural that it was for. And mm-hmm. so I would be confusing to casting people because mm-hmm. I was too tall to be Asian.
Right.
Yeah. Like, it's like,
Like, but suspiciously tall.
This is not what you're supposed to look like.
Drink a lot of milk.
That's right.
That's the thing, is maybe our generation, I feel like I'm older than you, but I feel like we're kind of similar generation. Our generation is like the first tall Asian Americans. Because we drank a lot of milk.
With like proper nutrition.
Yeah. Yeah. There's something like we didn't have rickets, that we stayed alive more than 100 days.
Yeah.
And we were able to weather the storm and became very, very tall. Whether it's I don't know what's in milk that makes people tall.
Now, you grew up in the Bay Area, right?
Correct.
Okay.
San Francisco.
So I grew up in outside of Chicago, which had like no Asian people.
Ooh.
And mm-hmm. which was a very like bad experience.
Yeah.
And I wonder what it would have been like growing up surrounded by Asians. Was that like good?
I think it was good, but also I have dyke face. So when you are perceived as gay,
okay.
then I think that it, you know, Asian kids, there really are a sense of like, if you get bullied for your race somewhere, and then you feel, you internalize that, if you can go back to people of your kind and find that weak link in the herd and bully them. So I kind of got a lot of, like, I really had a lot of problems with white kids and all of that. But then we'd have to go to Korean school or Sunday school or Korean churches, and then I would really get it from Korean kids. Mm-hmm. So I kind of felt very isolated, even when there were a lot of people who looked like me around.
Oh, okay. That's interesting.
So, but I can imagine, like, just thinking, like, if you're thinking about Chicago, like, what makes me think of that is a Long Duk Dong.
Sure. 16 John, Candles.
Yeah. John Hughes movies. Uh-huh. And, well, in that movie in particular, where you have this Asian character, which I think it's very difficult for a lot of Asian American men to look back on. And that's Chicago to me.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Embarrassing.
Yeah.
And when you are watching the movie with like a group of your friends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that character comes on the mm-hmm. screen and everyone kind of like looks at you mm-hmm. and is like laughing.
Yeah. Like, you should be enjoying this. Why it's aren't you like, enjoying yeah. this? This is for you. Like, this part's for you.
I'm mortified.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a hard thing because I think a lot of people, you know, I think about Phil Yu, you know, Angry Asian Man. Uh-huh. He's amazing. And he, you know, he talks about that character with, you know, great shame and anger around that.
And I feel like I read an interview with the actor too. Like,
Getty,
I felt like some real empathy for him.
I did too.
As far as like, you know, how do you turn down a part in like a major studio movie?
A huge movie. And how can you? You know, Getty is great. I mean, I know him personally. I think he's a great guy. I think he is somebody, like, for myself too, like, I understand that. Like, we had to take roles that, you know, I guess there was just nothing else, mm-hmm. you know. So whether that is something that is, you know, somebody is, like, can't speak English or heavily accented English and that kind of stuff, you know, it's like it doesn't stand the test of time.
For sure.
You know, but we didn't have other opportunities. So should we just be invisible? It's a choice between not existing or existing on someone else's terms.
Absolutely.
So that's something that I definitely grappled with. I was a lot younger, so it was almost the generation before us. And then I look at movies like Flower Drum Song and somebody like Nancy Kwan, mm-hmm.
Who is a cousin of mine.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like third or second.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
She's amazing.
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 Yeah.
I mean, and should have had a career like Natalie Wood. Mm-hmm. Or something, you know, had this, she was a major screen presence, like, you know, a real beauty mm-hmm. of that time, and a great actress and a dancer and singer, did everything. Had her pearl cream.
Pearl cream.
Remember pearl cream? Pearl cream. And we may be real Pearl.
Pearl Green.
Pearl. And, but I mean, just, you know, somebody that I look back on her and I think, wow, what an incredible person to have dealt with the 60s and racism towards Asian Americans, and also to be half at that point,
for
too,
sure.
to be biracial then was, you know, where do you feel like you can fit in anywhere?
Yeah.
You know, it's really interesting. But yeah, I think Kevin Kwan is also related to her, I believe.
Yeah.
Distant relative.
Kevin Kwan, also a cousin of mine.
Wow.
Author of the Crazy Rich Asians series.
Yeah. Which is now an amazing shift in the way we're going to look at Asian American culture, I think.
Sure.
From now on.
Yeah. I mean, I'm happy that stuff is getting made. I'm happy that you can have a romantic comedy like Crazy Rich Asians, Always Be My Maybe, which really just normalizes the idea that you can like be Asian and have a life in the world, and that it's not necessary. Like, I really would love to see just like any number of like horrible Chuck Lorre shows on CBS, but only with Asian actors.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
The idea that just we're just there, like we're there like everyone else.
Yeah.
Because I do feel like the pressure. I feel like there's a lot of pressure whenever there is like an all Asian cast or project. There's such a focus. There's such a spotlight on it that it has to really excel and really perform.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much pressure. Otherwise, it's like the momentum that we build up may just collapse.
Right.
You know, the minute something comes out and it's not an immediate hit.
Yeah. And there's also that kind of thing about it needing to be authentic.
Right.
That authenticity thing, which for me, it's like we never ask anything from white culture to be authentic.
Right.
You know, like there's nothing like that kind of, you know, you need that stamp of authenticity approval. But it's a strange thing. So I don't know exactly what that even means.
Uh-huh.
I think it comes out of, like, the one thing that I do know that Asian American culture is very, is kind of coming into a place of real renown is in the food world.
This is true.
So, you know, you see a lot of Asian American faces in, and you know, people from Asia, you know, from, like, something even like Martin Yan. Martin Yan was probably one of the first Asians that I remember seeing on TV.
Yeah, Yan Ken Cook.
Yeah. And very comedic. Mm-hmm. Like, he was real silly about it,
mm-hmm.
which sort of brought humor into the kitchen, and with his comedy, with his cleavers. And I think that it was, like, a different take on, like, that sort of the exoticized, like, the Chinese magician that you would see, like, in, like,
For
Ripley's
sure.
Believe It or Not. But he was here a chef, and, you know, he was, like, chopping up duck. And but now, you know, you have the Roy Choi's, and you have... Mm-hmm. All of this attention around it, you know, like night song market.
Right, you've got Chris song, from Night Market.
Night Market. There's Jazz from Jet Lada.
Jazz from Jet Lada.
There's all of these people. Yes.
Brandon Jew from Mr. Jew's in San Francisco.
Right.
Danny Bowen, David Chang. Yeah.
David Chang's a major one. Yeah, David Chang, that's so, like, he's so East Coast. You know, and all of his stuff sort of marries... food culture, like Lucky Peach and all the food shows and Anthony Bourdain. Like, I think that I used to think about, like, Anthony Bourdain as really, maybe it's actually not even just Anthony Bourdain, it's Jonathan Gold bringing mm-hmm. people into these restaurants that maybe white people were afraid to go to.
Absolutely. And and Jonathan, who was the critic for the LA Times and for the LA Weekly for many years, was such an ambassador for the city.
Mm-hmm.
And just such an incredible oracle of information, but really got people excited in a way that Bourdain did too, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just got people so excited to try new things in a way that no one else really was able to do.
Yeah. And well, I think with Anthony Bourdain, it's so amazing, you know, to go to these, like, sundubu restaurants or places in Koreatown or these little restaurants that after his death, and they all had little pictures of him up on their walls.
Mm-hmm.
And just they loved him so much because they know that he brought the white people.
Yeah.
You know, like, he brought the white people, which gave us an edge. You know,
absolutely.
That's like, you know, because in Koreatown, all these businesses are really fiercely competitive. And
sure.
You only go to the place that, you know, reminds you of maybe your mother's cooking. And then, you know, so I think a lot of times, like, white people don't know where to go because right. everything seems like so foreign and scary. But, you know, Anthony Bourdain gave us this sort of like entree into this world. Mm-hmm. And so his death was really, it was hugely mourned, as was Jonathan Gold's.
Absolutely.
Hugely mourned. Did you ever meet Jonathan?
Yes. Jonathan and I ate a few meals together over the years, and I met Bourdain once or twice, you know, but they were both obviously just exceedingly influential figures in my life, and I would not be able to do what I do now if, you know, were it not for them.
Yeah. I mean, it's what you're doing is the job of jobs. It is like I really have a love of food writing from MFK Fisher.
Sure.
So, you know, the way that she wrote about eating and food and her history with food and all of her stories, boarding school and food during the Depression and all of these mm-hmm. things, to me just lit up this world of, oh, there's so much to talk about because it's not just food, it's everything that we do around it. And, you know, in contrast to MFK Fisher's life, which was actually very difficult, you know, her husband's in severe pain. He's dying of cancer. I think he eventually commits suicide because of this overwhelming pain. So she's dealing with this man who's dying. And, you know, so she's looking to her writing about food to maybe seek some comfort there. Mm. So where does your food writing begin?
Well, I mean, that's such an interesting question. I mean, food, I think, is the sort of connective tissue for all of us. And it is the way, it's like a Trojan horse. So mm-hmm. it's a way to talk about other stuff sort of in the disguise of like the big wooden horse. It's like, oh, you think we're just going to talk about like kimchi stew, mm-hmm. but actually we're going to talk about like politics and immigration mm-hmm. and all of these sort of like deeper, more important issues that you can sort of ease your way into through the guise of food, because we all have that in common. Mm. And we all have everyone loves food. Like, we all have that interest in common.
Yeah.
And it really is the best way to make an immediate connection with someone you've never met mm-hmm. and to try to understand someone's culture and where someone is from.
Right.
So I think that's the interest for me mm-hmm. is that, you know, it's a common thing that we all love and that we all have a very strong opinion about. You know, everyone has whatever thing that they had as a kid that deeply resonates with them and that they feel deeply opinionated about. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's just a super good way to sort of foster understanding and like connect with people.
Mm-hmm. I think that's exactly true. Yeah. I think that's really, yeah, that's exactly true. And you hit them in a very primal place.
Absolutely.
You know, and I think, yeah, what I love is, I love the Eater series where you go through and you're looking at these very like inexpensive ways to dine, you know, dining on a dime, which is so great. I love anything like that's about frugality. And like, it reminds me a little bit of when you would have local news and you would have the greengrocer mm-hmm. and they're telling you what's fresh produce at the season.
Yeah.
But it's kind of related to that, you know, dining on a dime. You know, you're going all over, you're going all over the place.
Yeah, all
over
the world. Yeah.
All over the world, which is incredible. And really showing people, well, these are options for what you want to do. Because you're not just eating the delicious food, you're also getting a glimpse into this, you know, these different neighborhoods, these different places that people haven't even thought of.
Yeah, and I think the theory behind that, Dining on a Dime, which is a show I did for Eater, and I'm working on a new show now for the LA Times, which is where I work now as a mm-hmm. columnist, and the Frugal Traveler column I wrote for the New York Times for 3 years. And I sort of ended up getting into this like cheap frugal zone mm-hmm. sort of unintentionally, but it ended up being good in a lot of ways because I generally believe that like money separates you from people.
Right.
And when you go somewhere, be it a neighbor, you know, if you're going to Koreatown or if you're going to San Gabriel Valley, or if you're going, you know, even within around LA, or if you're traveling overseas, sort of the more money you throw at something, it only serves to sort of separate you from having like a good experience
mm-hmm.
and having a quote unquote, and it's a word I have a problem with, but like an authentic experience when you travel somewhere. It generally just serves to be like a wall between you and like the culture you're ostensibly trying to get to know.
Right.
And so by focusing on things that are cheap, and again, like it's not a thing that I don't have problems with, because I do, because I don't like the stereotype that certain foods have to be cheap or certain foods are expected mm-hmm. to be cheap. But I do think that by focusing on inexpensive foods that people actually eat in a neighborhood, you do get a better sense of what a place is like, as opposed to going to some super high end, you know, $300 or $400 tasting menu. Because
right.
I think that that's theater for, you know, for a particular group of
yeah.
people. And,
yeah.
and you're not going to really like have any sort of sense of what it's like to be living in Chengdu or Hanoi or mm-hmm. any of these places, you know, if you separate yourself with like a bag full of money.
Yeah.
So that is why I like to focus on things that are, you know, quote unquote, cheaper and expensive.
Yeah. I mean, that's real terroir. You know, like you're really tasting the environment.
Mm-hmm.
You're tasting the soil that grew all of it, you know, the world there, that part of the world that sustains it, you know.
At the same time, I think it's like fucked up that people don't want to pay money for Asian food, or people don't
like
don't want to pay money for Mexican food, or think
oh,
that
yeah,
like
yeah.
tacos should be a dollar, and think that like a bowl of pho is expensive if it's more than $7, but people are willing to eat fucking like $30 agnolotti at the Italian place. Like
right,
like that's
right.
insane to me. So mm-hmm. that's sort of why I don't like the cheap aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
But so there's like sort of a push and pull there, because I do think that the cuisines need to be respected and treated equally, and that, you know, Italian and French food, which people are willing to shell out a lot of
right.
money for, you know, people aren't willing to do that for Asian food.
Exactly. You know, you're really, yeah, that's right. It's like you feel you come at it like this is like where you could see where this is where the colonial mindset kind of like comes into play, you know, and it's so complicated, because it's like what we do pay for, mm-hmm. you know, what we think of as being really special.
Mm-hmm.
And I think like my I have a friend who's German who, you know, was really, really kind of trying to make me understand why it was so hard to grow up next to France, because they felt such a sense of like never measuring up.
That's so funny.
To France in all of its culture, and
felt guilty about invading them.
Yeah.
Or just,
but how hard, you know, the food is like not, you know, measured in the same way,
right?
You know, and so that there's that thing. There's like kind of an inferiority complex around it. Or I would think of a like. You know, the white people trying to best each other in Europe, like when it's all about Nordic food.
Right, right, right.
The Nordic food explosion.
Absolutely.
It's like now we're all about like salmon roe,
mm-hmm.
and not the Japanese way. Mm-hmm. We're going to do it the Nordic way. Like Nordic food for, you know, a couple of years there became like the gold standard. I think, you know, I think it still is.
Yeah. I mean, Noma is still, you know, right up there with mm-hmm. one in Denmark.
Have you eaten there?
I have not eaten at Noma, no, but I would love to go.
It's crazy. I got to interview Renee, and I went and I did a day of the meal takes about 3.5 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a lunchtime a service, and then I sat with the staff, you know, for staff meal in between them and then dinner service.
Oh,
and
cool.
And so it was really interesting to go back, you know, into the kitchen, and they were all having these pastries with a chocolate that had been made out of seaweed, which was just, I mean, I think, you know, it's just as beautiful for the staff meal as it is for the patrons.
Right.
So it's real artistry that they do.
It is super, it is incredible artistry. And the stuff that happens in, you know, in China and Korea, and I think Japan has now been elevated to the, you know, people do associate Japanese food and sushi with like artisanal, you know, these great skilled chefs,
mm-hmm.
but that still has not carried over into other countries, like
right.
Vietnamese food, which is incredible.
So incredible.
Or Chinese food, which
yeah.
is just like a fucking endless trove
yeah.
of like, you can never get to the bottom of like what Chinese food is.
Yeah.
And yet no one can name a Chinese chef.
Right.
Like literally not like a chef from China,
mm-hmm.
even though one of the most incredible chefs in the world and in China, this guy named Yu Bo, who's trying to open a restaurant now in LA, he lives here now.
Mm-hmm.
But no one knows who he is.
Mm-hmm.
Because for whatever reason, we've never elevated a Chinese chef or any Asian chef who's like, you know, to the level of like Rene Redzepi or
mm-hmm.
Magnus from Fabiken, the restaurant in Sweden.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's just like, hopefully it'll happen. And like being able to sort of catch up and say, hey, you know, when you make something from flour and water and it's Italian, it should, you know, you should justify paying as much for something that's made from flour and water, like noodles, that,
mm-hmm.
that is a Chinese dish. Because
exactly.
like because the craft and like the skill and the dedication to like making something great is there equally.
Yeah.
You know?
But I think it sort of comes it relates back to like the emergence of Chinese restaurants in America where
sure.
you wouldn't even have the name of something. You would order food by the number
mm-hmm.
because the name was just so difficult you couldn't possibly say it, you know.
Yeah.
And that like all of it sort of had to be you know, internally regulated, so all Chinese restaurants sort of have the same structure so that
right.
we like white people could understand this vastly strange food.
And then you've got like Chinese American cuisine, which is sort of like its own separate thing.
Right.
Where you've got like the really sweet and sticky, like General Tso's kind of thing, which mm-hmm. is sort of like its own creation. You know, when white people discovered Chinatowns as like a place to visit
mm-hmm.
and a place to go,
mm-hmm.
You know, restaurateurs needed to tailor their menus for the palates of
mm-hmm.
the people who visited.
Yeah.
And so you've got that, which is like an entirely different thing. But yeah, the idea that, and something that I really love about LA and something that Jonathan taught me about LA is that like, there are all of these little neighborhoods that are these like incubators for food. And you've got, you know, Alhambra and Monterey Park and SGV, and you've got, you know, Koreatown, and you've got Westminster and Garden Grove for Vietnamese food. And like, these are all places that are so far apart from each other and
mm-hmm.
from like the center, you know, the quote unquote center of LA commercially, they've been able to like develop independent of anything else. So like, they're not counting on me to come and visit and patronize them. They don't care. They're there to serve their own community.
Mm-hmm.
The Vietnamese restaurants in Westminster are there for Vietnamese people.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're not trying to, they could care less about attracting, you know, a white person from West Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of like allows, and that's what makes the cuisine so good is
mm-hmm.
that it is, you know, by Vietnamese people for Vietnamese people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes LA kind of special.
Right.
Because it is so vast and you do have to like go such a long way.
Mm-hmm.
And these places can sort of like grow and develop independent of other places in LA.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's very true. That's very true. What do you think is the next kind of place that, or what the next kind of cuisine or ethnic cuisine that is going to come up? I think I have a feeling like it is going to be either kind of like the Shanghai, like a rice pancake or like a green onion pancake kind of. What's the sandwich that you featured that's in a restaurant in San Francisco on Irving and like 9th Avenue that's in another restaurant that does the Chinese pancake sandwiches?
The thing that you put the big flat thing in that's like a pancake?
Yeah.
That's super delicious.
Yeah.
And I remember you can get those all over China and it's like a breakfast thing.
Yeah.
And I think that could definitely, it's interesting. When we're talking about sort of like what's the next, you know, cuisine, you know, so, you know, quote unquote ethnic cuisine that's going to be popular. I think I read something, I forget what website it was on, about how like America loves immigrants, but only for their food, like, which I think is kind of,
it's true.
Which I think is like
yeah.
kind of
it's
like
real.
Depressing and
yeah.
true.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think about that as far as like food media and like latching onto trends. But the fact is that like, you know, people do sort of, you know, find certain cuisines, whether it's Filipino cuisine, which has
mm-hmm.
made a big resurgence in the past few years with
yeah.
places like Mam Sur and
mm-hmm.
places like Lhasa. And
mm.
But Taiwanese food.
Yeah.
Taiwanese breakfast. Shanghainese. Our critic at the LA Times just reviewed a Shanghainese place, Jiangnan Spring in the SGV, which is by Golden Deli, that Vietnamese place. Mm-hmm. It's tough to say. I mean, the cuisine that's really having its moment right now, at least in the sort of Chinese realm, is still Sichuan food.
Yeah.
And just like super fiery hot.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah.
And hot pot and mm-hmm. things like that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm not sure.
That hot pot is really, that's really Mikey Chen territory.
Oh, yeah.
He loves the hot pot. He loves that any kind of hot pot. And well, I think Mikey Chen is great. Like, I think it's like what's so fun about food and YouTube uh-huh. is I watch you, I watch Mikey Chen, and then I watch Mark Wayans.
Right.
You guys, and it's so it's Hoppa dominated.
Yeah.
Right?
Well.
Which is very cool.
We are a very, you know, we're genetically superior.
That's right.
People.
With the best palate.
That's right.
Mikey Chen is funny because he has food, not food phobias, but he has distinct dislikes that I think are like, well, if you're a food critic, you've got to like your raw fish. But really doesn't have a fondness for that. There's certain things that he doesn't like that I'm like, wow, that's interesting for a food critic not to want. Are there things that you don't like?
There are some things I don't like. I've tried to learn to at least try everything mm-hmm. and to really get into, especially with a lot of the Asian cuisines, get into the texture, into like the tendon and like the chewiness of like chicken feet, and to really like appreciate that mm-hmm. because it is such a huge, you know, element of Asian cuisines. Is like, it's not just the taste. Like it's about the texture mm-hmm. and something that's like really chewy or something that's like really gummy. And you kind of got to like get into it.
Ooh, it's like, or metallic.
Yeah, yeah.
Like metallic, like that's sundae, which is the blood sausage, Korean blood sausage, or any kind of blood cube, any kind of blood stew, you know, like the tamale in lobster.
Oh, sure.
The green, or like the roe in a crab. Mm-hmm. It's that green. Those taste very metallic. It might just be the mercury.
Yeah, you should probably ease up on the...
That's kind of scary.
On the bluefin tuna.
Well, that when I I went to Tsukiji before it moved.
Okay.
You know, and Tsukiji Fish Market in Tokyo. And I had huge anxiety because of all of the things that were being drawn out of the sea daily. Because if you go to that market before, I mean, I think some of it's closed to the public now.
I went and I tried to go and it was closed because the day before a British tourist had licked a tuna.
Oh.
Like as a joke.
No.
He was like,
why?
It's like a fucking $500,000 tuna.
No.
And he licked it to be funny.
What? I mean, Ariana Grande licked that donut? Was it that?
Yeah.
I mean, she just licked a donut.
But instead of a 79 cent donut, it's like a $500,000 tuna.
Oh my God.
And so they like shut the place down.
Yeah.
Which they rightly so.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, but that is terrible.
Yeah, it was really stupid.
I mean, it's terrible. I mean, I wonder what it tasted like to just ice.
Yeah, probably.
His tongue probably just stuck to it.
I imagine it was frozen, you know.
But the amount of things that they take out of the sea daily.
One place I've never been, and I'm ashamed to say just through the airport, but I've never spent any meaningful time in Korea. Ever at all. And I need to go.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think that, if you like fermentation.
Love it.
Then you would have a good time.
Stinky.
I love stinky, earthy. I love Korea. I have a lot of baggage when I go, like, because of the...
tell me.
Kind of just like the, you know, I have to remember all my honorifics. But you know what's good now is that I'm 50 years old now. So when I go to Korea, I'm actually the grandma.
Oh, wow.
Now I'm the hominy. So I have like this unearned respect that I get immediately in the culture because I'm old.
It's like exhausting when I go to China.
Yeah.
Because obviously everyone expects you to speak whatever the language. And I don't know how good your Korean is. My Chinese is okay.
Mm-hmm.
And but it's really hard. Like, mm-hmm. I like the sort of the expectation and sort of like that kind of look of disappointment in people's faces when you open your mouth and you're like not very good at like asking where the subway is. I just find it like emotionally exhausting to like go to China.
Yeah.
Because you're not like I don't feel Chinese. And mm-hmm. then it's also sort of emotionally exhausting to be here when you don't feel American. So it's like you know what I mean?
Yeah. It's like you just don't belong anywhere.
Yeah.
But what I find about it is that when they know that you're trying mm-hmm. to speak the language, they are so appreciative.
That is true.
They try to receive it with such, it's like they're being presented with a gift.
That is true.
They really, really appreciate the effort, and that I think says a lot.
Yeah.
You know, and it's really nice. And but yeah, it is definitely like at first it's really like I turn into a kid because mm-hmm. that was like the last time I really spoke Korean fluently yeah. as a child. So I think I regress emotionally. But it's strange to go back and in the stages of your life and how much Asian culture reveres age.
Mm.
So that's kind of gratifying too.
Yeah.
That's what I like. If you like fermentation, if you like anything with rice flour that's chewy,
yeah.
Any kind of a mochi or like a duck thing.
I love it.
I could just eat that.
Do you have favorite places in K-Town?
I'm so basic that I am just really into the BCDs.
Sure.
So I'll just go to the BCD because it's something that like I can go to with friends and I don't have to explain a lot of stuff.
Let's get your tofu.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just get like, you know, that kind of food is, I think is really, to me, what I really love. I love a rice bakery, like any of those rice bakeries that are in like the malls.
Mm-hmm.
And then probably my favorite sundubu place is, I think, was it? Beverly Sundubu.
Right. Yeah, it's Beverly Sundubu Tofu. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the one.
That place is great.
Yeah. It's on Olympic and Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then, yeah, Parks Barbecue, of course, everybody loves. Right. And there's like also an Imperial Korean cuisine. Is it Sheila? Maybe it's across the street. I don't know. I don't know if that one, the name of, but it's the ones where you get like a private room for dining. So, that I would go with my family. Now I like that, you know, I like that pureed pumpkin.
Oh, yeah.
Do you have a favorite Korea town?
I'm trying to think of the place that I really like for cold noodles. The
Naengmyeon. North Korean delight.
Yeah.
North Korean and perfect for summer.
I forget the name of the place now. The place for Junwon has really good bosam.
Bosam is great, yeah.
And love Beverly Soon. I mean, I like all of the sort of drinking holes, the Dunsung Sa's and the Digul mm-hmm. Mooks mm-hmm. and the place where you, the military themed bars in K-Town.
Oh, yeah.
Like, where you get the cheese corn. And
I love, it's like the, there's sort of that big complex on 6th and mm-hmm. you go behind and there's that really famous Kabi restaurant and then there's the bar that has sort of like water features and I just love any kind of like Koreatown restaurant because there's going to be like a white grand piano
right.
and a waterfall somewhere.
True. And the Prince. I like the Prince.
Oh, the Prince is good.
Which is just like a bar.
Yeah, the Prince is where my dad would probably go eat the sannachi, which is that my dad is very like macho, so he loves like the live squid, it's actually like octopus.
Oh, wow.
You know, wrapped around chopsticks and killed with your teeth.
I don't feel good about it.
It doesn't taste like anything either. Like it's not really like you can flavor it with anything because like soy sauce kind of hurts them too. So, I mean, I don't know why you care about hurting them before they die, but in your mouth.
I guess it just kind of appeals to that idea that you're like killing something or
it's
like
macho.
Hunting something. Yeah,
it's macho. Like my dad is like kind of a macho foodie. I don't know what that is, but he's very much like that. Like, oh, you know, I'm going to eat this chicken that was only fed snakes.
Yeah. Just see if you can really taste the snake.
Yeah, that you can taste the snake.
Yeah.
I do like snake soup that you could get in Hong Kong. I do like that.
Yeah.
It's like very chicken noodle.
For my birthday in China, they fed me an entire snake. So like they made something from the meat and then they made soup from the bones and then they fried the skin. You eat the skin and then you drink the blood.
Mm.
And so you like consume the whole thing and it's supposed to be like symbolic for virility or something.
I love it.
I guess. But this is also like a culture where like whatever body part hurts, you eat that part of right. the animal.
Which kind of makes sense, doesn't
it? Sort of. Or if you're like,
kind of.
Or if you're impotent, like you eat a horse dick because you think that's going to make you virile or something like that.
Yeah. So. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I've never actually had horse. A horse is something you would get in Europe or Venice. I remember going to like a horse market.
Or in Central Asia. Yeah. They right. eat horse meat. Mm-hmm. And they do in Italy, too. I had some in Sicily. They eat horse meat.
Now, but there's no horse meat in America, is there?
I don't know if you can do that here. Mm-hmm. I know there was like a little bit of a controversy some years ago for horse meat that was found in those IKEA meatballs, but I don't.
No.
Yeah, I think I read something about that.
Hmm.
But yeah, I don't think that's really kosher in this country.
Hmm. Now, I want people to be able to watch your new show. I'm going to watch it. When is it? So it's going to be on, is it YouTube?
Okay. So we're shooting it and we're almost done. We have a name for it that I'm not, do you have like a good name for a show? We're trying to think of names for the show right now that are not really sticking. But it is like a food exploration show. It's the idea that the best way you get to know food in a place, in this case, Los Angeles, is through the different neighborhoods. So we're going to do all of these. We're going to go to Thai Town and see jazz. And then we're going to go to Laxi, which is this huge Thai Costco close to downtown, and go shopping and then cook together.
Oh, great.
And so, you know, stuff like that.
I love jazz.
And so that is hopefully rolling out this summer, either on LATimes.com or I'm not exactly sure what we're doing. But it's going to be good.
Yeah.
It's super, super exciting.
That's
great. And then all of the old Dining on a Dime episodes I did for Eater, those are still, you can still watch those on YouTube.
Yeah. And they're really, really informative. I think it's great if you're going to that city, you know, that you can like do, you know, look at the episodes I want to eat there.
Yeah,
like
for sure.
I did that actually when I went to Toronto.
Oh, you did?
Yeah. So
oh,
I neat. And I went to that pho place.
Oh, you did?
Yes. Delicious.
The turtle. Yeah. Golden something. Yeah.
Yeah. Delicious. Yeah.
Super good.
So delicious. My favorite. And I want to read. Yeah, I read you now. You're on the LA Times. You're writing for the LA Times.
Writing for the LA Times.
Yes.
Writing for the food section.
So people, you know, read and eat. And what are your handles?
Twitter at Lucas Peterson, Instagram. Instagram at Stale Twizzlers.
Stale Twizzlers.
Yes.
Because they're better if they're stale.
You can kind of like just gnaw on them all day.
And it's better than a paper straw.
And also, Lucas Peterson was taken on Instagram. So
yeah, mine too. Margaret Cho's taken. I know. And then it says Margaret Cho, not the comedian.
No.
And I'm like, what the?
Well, I mean, they're probably getting like a bunch of follows because
they
think that people think that they're you.
Yeah. Or people think that I'm not a comedian.
Not.
She's not.
A comedian.
She's really not. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I really had fun.
Me too.
Never miss an episode of The Margaret Show. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Coming out of the dark. Yeah. Coming out of the dark. Yeah, yeah, I'm coming out of the dark.
Earios.
Powered by Acast.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want to get a chiseled look in the jawline? Sculpt and shape your jawline with added volume from Juvederm Volux XC. Juvederm Volux XC is an injectable gel specifically designed to be robust enough to improve moderate to severe loss of jawline definition. And it is the first and only hyaluronic acid filler approved for the jawline. Add volume to your jawline for a chiseled look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you. Visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com.